This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is the Washington Post for Monday, April 29th. I'm Claire, reading for Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. The top story today: the protests outside her window at Columbia University were loud, and Dahlia Susan lay awake all night, tossing in her dorm room bed, a little bit scared. As a Jewish student, some of the chants felt threatening, like she was being targeted because she supports the existence of the State of Israel. But the next day, when more than 100 protesters were arrested, that was upsetting too. She didn't want the students taken to jail or suspended from college. She, too, wants the bombing in Gaza to stop. "Every value that I hold in my heart is in tension with another principle I hold deeply right now," said Susan, a junior at Barnard College, which is affiliated with Columbia. In the days that followed, her anger and sadness would grow. So would her frustration, as she saw friends unwilling to take a stand against what she saw as anti-Semitism on campus. When she went home to Toronto for the Jewish holiday of Passover, part of her didn't want to come back to New York, but she did. "I can't walk away from something that's hard," she said. For Jewish college students, this is a moment of intense and sometimes conflicting emotions, as many college campuses erupt in loud protest against Israel's conduct in the war, and in some cases its existence, all while the deadly war in Gaza presses on and Israeli hostages remain in captivity. It adds up to profound questions over what it means to be a young Jew in America in 2024. For some, the overriding feeling is one of fear and pain. Others have joined with the protesters, seeing the opposition to the war in Gaza as an opportunity to live out Jewish values taught growing up about justice and the value of human life. And many others are conflicted, seeing nuance when it feels like so many around them see black and white. A lot of students I talk with in the last few months are genuinely torn and confused, but don't feel they can ask their questions, said Rabbi Jill Jacobs, a human rights advocate who helps train rabbinical students and others. "It's been that way since October 7th, she said, when the war began with an attack on Israel by Hamas, the militant group that runs Gaza, killing about 1,200, according to Israeli estimates, and taking more than 250 hostage. After that, Israel launched a counterattack that has killed over 34,000 Gazans, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Jewish students are left pinballing between emotions, worry over Israel's safety and the fate of the hostages, fear of rising anti-Semitism at home, empathy for Palestinians. They are horrified by what's happening in Gaza and also by what happened on October 7th and by anti-Semitism," she said. "They don't see enough models for how to hold it all." Seeing a Columbia-like encampment spread to the University of Pittsburgh in recent days has been terrifying to Elitza Houchhauser, president of the Orthodox Jewish group Chabad on campus. The junior said she saw a rules sign at the encampment that included "Don't talk to Zionists." The rules also said to love each other, which she found contradictory. Someone inside the encampment told a friend of hers to go back to Europe, she said. "I think people make uneducated assumptions. They look at Jewish students and assume what they believe. They assume the Jewish students want a certain group of people dead, which isn't true at all, whatsoever. What everyone wants is peace," she said. "Sometimes there is a productive dialogue on campus," Houchhauser said, "but other times it's difficult. Some people don't really want to talk constructively," she said. Jewish students on campus are very involved right now because, to put it bluntly, everyone is a little scared about where this is going. In a survey conducted in December and January by the University of Chicago's Chicago Project on Security and Threats, 19% of college students reported feeling in personal danger due to their support of Israel or Palestinians. But those feelings were far more widespread among Jewish and Muslim students, where more than half said they feel in danger. The survey also found that 13% of college students agreed or neither agreed nor disagreed with the statement, "When Jews are attacked, they deserve it," and 17% said the same about supporters of Israel. Separately, Hill Hill International, a major network of campus Jewish groups, said its members have recorded more than 1,350 incidents considered anti-Semitic, including social media posts, vandalism, assaults, and harassments since the October 7th attack. That includes over 400 attacks 400 acts of vandalism, said Adam Lehman, president and CEO of the group. This year, and in particular the past week, has been very crystallizing for many young Jews, he said. At Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, senior Leo Spunt experienced what felt like hate firsthand last fall when someone pulled down the mezuzah, a small scroll with religious text inside a little case that he had posted on the doorway of his room in his fraternity house. He thought it might have been an accident, maybe someone was drunk and he replaced it. Then the second one was pulled down too. I feel like I can't trust the people I live with who are around me, he said. He got a third mezuzah from Hillel but never put it up. Protests and pro-Palestinian actions are common at the Claremont Colleges, a network of schools outside of Los Angeles. Ben Cohen, a junior at one of them, Pitzer College, tries to steer clear, but said he can't help feeling uncomfortable, even unsafe. I've seen swastikas on campus. I've been called a filthy Jew for wearing a Star of David on campus, he said. There is no voice for us, no conversation. I feel I'm just being yelled at rather than being heard. Cohen, who grew up in Marin County, California, said that in middle school someone put a swastika in his backpack, and in high school he saw Nazi salutes. I've dealt with this since I was 13, and right now this is the most antisemitism I've ever experienced. Cohen says he still proudly wears his star, which hangs on a necklace. I feel like I hold a stronger bond now to Judaism, he said. The moment we break, I break. Our people break. That's when they win. While some Pitzer students were feeling under attack, Ezra Levinson, a first-year student there from Hawaii, described a very different experience. Levinson is an organizer with Jewish Voice for Peace, which rejects the current state of Israel and the idea of a Jewish nation-state in which Jews have more rights than others. The group has staged several protests on campus in recent months. What's critical right now is to take necessary steps to stop the loss of life and to address the fact that Palestinians are being killed and forced out of homes on a mass scale by Israel, Levinson said, and it's being perpetrated in our name as Jews. Last week, Levinson attended a campus Passover Seder run by the Orthodox Hasidic group Chabad. They wore a kefa, there was disagreement, and it was beautiful. There were people speaking in different ways about Israel and the violence, and we were able to coexist in that space as Jews, they said. A lot of it is about shared values and remembering the empathy and justice Judaism can give all of us. A Pew Research Center poll about the war conducted in February shows younger Americans and younger American Jews are more reticent about supporting Israel than their older counterparts. 26% of Jews age 18 through 34, for instance, said President Biden is favoring the Israelis too much, twice the percentage of American Jews overall, according to the poll. And the Chicago Report survey showed how the same words can be interpreted differently by different people. For instance, 66% of Jewish students interpreted the phrase from the river to the sea to mean Palestinians should replace Israelis in the territory, even if it means the expulsion or genocide of Israeli Jews. Among all students, 26% interpreted that way, with roughly the same share interpreting the phrase to be a call for two nations side by side. Across the country, at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, freshman Elijah Bacall was also feeling spiritually lifted by connecting with people on both camps of this debate. He is deeply involved in both mainstream Jewish life and pro-Palestinian protest on campus, as he puts it, straddling two worlds. He prays every Shabbat at the main Jewish community center on campus, is associate editor of Yale's undergraduate Jewish journal, and joins a group on Mondays singing niggins or wordless Jewish spiritual melodies. He is also a founder of Yale Jews for Ceasefire, which calls for a stop to fighting in Gaza, return of the hostages, and an end of the Israeli occupation and blockade of Gaza. He has been a regular presence on the campus encampment, running the Instagram feed. I don't see a contradiction. In fact, they feed each other, he said Wednesday. Work to create a more just and equal world is part and parcel with my Judaism and my spirituality, he said. Protesting the war, he said, has given him a palpable spiritual connection for the first time, deepening, not questioning, his faith. Leaders at the Slivka Jewish Center had asked Bacall several weeks ago to deliver last week's Shabbat talk on the question, "What does Judaism mean to you?" He worked hard on a piece about how important Jewish rituals, the center and the campus Jewish community are to him, and how the unity he feels there is forged from our profound diversity. His talk didn't directly mention the war or politics. On Thursday night, leaders at Slivka told Bacall that a staffer would give the talk instead. Tensions had flared at Yale in the past week, including arrest after a demonstration on campus. Rabbi Jason Rubenstein, Yale's Jewish chaplain, told the Washington Post that leaders at Slivka felt a need to speak in a broad way with pastoral urgency. Bacall felt shaken and confused. He was torn between wanting to trust leadership about the reasons and doubt over whether his pro-Palestinian activism might be playing a role. Rubenstein told the Post that it was not a factor. Shortly before the Sabbath began, a student leader from the center shared Bacall's talk with the community by email, calling it beautiful, but Bacall was still upset at the turn of events. Since October 7th, there's been a lot of talk at Slivka about this word pluralism, and me giving this talk feels like low-hanging fruit in terms of making that happen, he said Friday night. Then there are those who feel out of place everywhere they go. Lauren Haynes, a junior at the University of Michigan, has long opposed the Israeli government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. As national president of J Street U, the student branch of a liberal advocacy group, she supports a two-state solution, with Palestinians living in peace beside Israelis. She is horrified by the number of Palestinians who have been killed by Israeli bombs. Yet she supports the existence of the State of Israel and is deeply unsettled by vandalism on campus and hateful comments, including a call by a student leader for death and more for everyone who supports the Zionist state. Holding my point of view, which is one of nuance and complexity, is really difficult, she said. This past week and honestly the past 6 months have been hell. Haynes, 21, who is from Athens, Georgia, said she doesn't think she should have to choose between innocent Israelis and innocent Palestinians. She said people should stand up for Palestinians and call out anti-Semitism. I always tell people I stand on the side of humanity, which for some reason on college campuses is not a popular view, she said. There are people on both sides who are hurting right now. Campus politics make this even harder. She said she identifies with progressive politics on every other issue. Now there is a coalition of groups supporting university divestment from Israel, and J Street is one of the only liberal groups that has not signed on. It's really hard feeling alienated from the left because, in my mind, being a leftist or being a progressive means you stand for equal rights for everyone. You stand for justice for everyone, she said. Before enrolling at Barnard College last fall, Yakira Galler had spent a gap year studying in Israel about the shared future of Israelis and Palestinians. Once in New York, she planned to dive into dialogue with these communities, but she said she was met with a complete wall of resistance from anti-Israel students. After October 7th, it got worse. She said that this month, as tensions over the encampment and the calling in of police soared, she began hearing anti-Semitic and even pro-terrorism rhetoric. She saw videos of people at Columbia holding a sign in front of Jewish students that said, "Al-Qassam's next targets," referencing Hamas's military wing, and her chants at Columbia of, "Hamas, we love you, keep bombing Tel Aviv." Her first year of college, she said, had been very painful, and I'm filled with a lot of fear and anxiety, especially on campus, she said. I completely disagree that these protests are peaceful. They are shouting for violence, Galler, 20, said. Through these months, she said she has lost friends. When she registered for classes, she checked to see if professors have signed open letters against Israel. Lately, she has tried to stay off social media to avoid posts about Israel from her classmates. She came to college hoping to be immersed in communities of Jews and non-Jews, but now that feels more complicated. Still, she said she remains deeply committed to dialogue. For Dalia Susan, the sleepless night at Barnard, listening to protesters outside her window was scary. But the most frustrating moments for her have been among friends, not strangers. Susan is a resident assistant in a Barnard residence hall and part of the union that represents RAs. After police cleared the encampment at Columbia right next door, the RAs and the union pushed for a resolution condemning the action. Susan and some other Jewish RAs worried about the message this would send to Jewish students who might feel like the statement was endorsing some of the hateful rhetoric espoused by the protesters. "It is not our place to send out messages that are divisive," one woman wrote in a group chat shared with the Post. Another suggested a statement simply recognizing how hard things have been for students of all views. But others felt it was important to call out the police involvement, which one RA wrote is making people feel unsafe. A statement was quickly drafted, won majority approval, and was posted online, noting that it was endorsed by 30-plus members of the union. That weekend, Susan went home to Toronto for Passover, and one rabbi serving Orthodox students at Columbia suggested it was not safe for Jews to be on campus. With tensions so high, Susan texted the RA group chat and suggested a statement condemning antisemitism. "Just as we stood up for students who were targeted by NYPD and the administration for protesting, I feel we also need to write a statement on behalf of the union, assuring Jewish students that we stand with them in the face of antisemitism," she wrote. She agreed to a suggestion that the statement also condemn anti-Muslim hate. Still late Monday, after her family's Passover Seder was over, she went online and learned that there were not enough votes to pass the statement. "I am tremendously disheartened and disturbed that we couldn't get enough votes. Our inability to join together in condemning hatred against Jews on our campus cast a stain of bigotry on this union and some of its leadership," she wrote in the group chat. That night, she again couldn't sleep. Here were women she thought of as friends unwilling to take the stand. She was staying with her grandmother and went into her room at 3 a.m. to find she was awake, too. She sat down on the bed next to her grandmother and let the whole story out. She left for the airport just a few hours later and kept crying, thinking about what she would be returning to. Back in New York, she kept pushing. When there was talk in the union of a new statement, Susan offered to write it. The message voiced concern about an increase in surveillance on campus and its impact on Black, Brown, and Muslim students, but said the union was equally concerned by the recent surge in anti-Semitic incidents on campus. Late Friday night, it passed. Union leaders asked about the previous failure, pointed the Post to the new statement on Instagram. The approval was heartening to Susan, but it still bothered her that a standalone statement about anti-Semitism could not be approved. "I'm feeling a little bit jaded about anti-Semitism on campus," she said, "but I feel resolved to continue showing up and advocating." For 20 minutes, Donald Trump campaigned like everything was normal. He made his way down a line of cheering fans outside a construction site at 6:30 a.m., pumping his fists, clasping outstretched hands, and signing MAGA hats. "Election interference," he grumbled about the criminal charges against him, reprising his year-long mantra. But by 9:30 a.m., Trump was stuck in court, no longer narrating the legal saga intertwined with his run for president. He sat quietly for hours at a time Thursday and watched stone-faced as a longtime friend and former tabloid publisher recounted Trump's agitation in 2016 when a hush money scheme failed to quash a story about an alleged affair with a Playboy model. His go-to outlet, brief interludes in a dingy courthouse hallway in front of TV cameras, where he has vented about the judge, the freezing temperatures in the courtroom, and sitting up as straight as I can all day long. 2 weeks in, the first criminal trial of a former president has been personally taxing for Trump and disruptive to his campaign. Despite efforts to schedule dinners where donors, friends, and world leaders join him, Trump's moods are worse on trial days, according to several people close to him. The former president is accustomed to near daily rounds of golf, constant stimulation, and cheers when he enters and exits a room at Mar-a-Lago, they said. Instead, he is now reporting 4 days a week for mundane court arguments and long stretches without permission to check his phone. "The phrase around here is, 'the process is the punishment,'" said one person close to Trump, who, like others, spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe private conversations. Trump has done his best to turn his trial into an extension of his 2024 campaign, raging that the case is politically motivated and bragging that he can assemble adoring crowds even in heavily Democratic Manhattan. He has marveled to advisors that he gets more media attention outside court than he even did on the campaign trail, and that his comments are sometimes carried live. But the indictments that once helped Trump lock down the GOP nomination by firing up his base have become a serious constraint in the general election and thrust the domineering candidate into an unusually humbling position. The trial is taking time and resources, just as his campaign is rushing to build out infrastructure for the general election and close a fundraising gap with President Biden. Expected to stretch 6 to 8 weeks, the trial is limiting the schedule of the presumptive GOP nominee at a critical moment when Biden is outspending him on the airwaves and seeing some improvement in the polls. Though Trump's team notes the former president still holds an edge in many surveys of a very tight race. During the Republican primaries, Trump could swoop in and out of his court proceedings with more flexibility and campaign on the sidelines. Now the former president is required to attend, adding insult to injury. His first mid-trial rally was canceled last weekend because of bad weather. Next week, Trump is planning to squeeze two rallies in Michigan and Wisconsin into his off day. His team was angered that the judge chose Wednesday as the day off, believing it was meant to hurt him politically. He has trekked to his club in Westchester to play golf on the days he has been off, instead of hitting the trail. Although Trump has consistently survived major scandals, the New York case is training new attention on salacious allegations that could give some voters pause. Trump is accused of falsifying business records to conceal a hush money payment to an adult film actress whose allegations of an extramarital affair with Trump threatened to hurt his 2016 campaign. He has pleaded not guilty. Trump campaign senior advisor Jason Miller, who has been attending court with the former president, rejected the idea that the trial has dampened Trump's mood or hindered his campaign, despite what he called some justifiable outrage about the case. He said Trump keeps telling us to load up his schedule with events. Obviously, Trump would rather be in battleground states, Miller said, but we have a great candidate. We have a phenomenal airplane. We're going to bring the campaign trail to us. Trump has settled into a predictable, if surreal, rhythm for the trial, with his court appearances punctuated by all caps, social media posts, and brief combative remarks in front of the press. He fields questions occasionally, sometimes ignoring reporters' shouted queries. "I love to say everything that's on my mind," Trump lamented to reporters this past week, chafing at a gag order forbidding him to talk publicly about witnesses, jurors, and some other people linked to the case. Prosecutors complained to the judge that Trump was still not restrained. "He's been violating the gag order right outside the door," Assistant District Attorney Christopher Conroy said. The outcome of the trial could sway some voters, polling shows, and Trump faces three other criminal cases, though it's unclear if any others will go to trial before the election. Nearly a quarter of registered voters who backed Trump say a conviction in one of his cases might cause them to reconsider supporting him, according to a CNN poll conducted April 18th through 23rd. Americans were evenly split on whether Trump has been treated more harshly or more leniently than other defendants, underscoring how voters of different political persuasions and backgrounds are absorbing Trump's legal woes in very different ways. Trump's lawyers have argued that there is nothing improper and attacked the credibility of a central witness, former Trump attorney Michael Cohen. On his first Monday in court, Trump emerged with his trademark red tie, shoulders slightly hunched to denounce proceedings as a political persecution, an assault on our country, and really an attack on a political opponent. Despite Trump's claims, there is no evidence that local prosecutors have coordinated with Biden or his administration. "So I'm very honored to be here," Trump concluded. The trial has been a jarring shift for a man who is rarely confined to silence, often around people paying to see him, and used to spending his days making phone calls, holding meetings, reading newspapers, tending to his properties, taping videos, and peacocking around his Mar-a-Lago club in Florida. Trump has also long prized having control of many of the details in his day-to-day life, people familiar with the matter said. He largely avoids restaurants outside his properties because he wants control over the food, particularly how a steak is cooked. He has avoided certain hotels on the road, telling advisors he prefers a Holiday Inn Express because the bathroom floors are light-colored and he can see if there is dirt. At his property, he controls the music, both the song choice and the volume. He was personally involved in renovating his plane, asking for constant updates, and complained about having to use the private planes of others while his was in the shop for over a year. Last year, a group of Trump advisors and lawyers spoke with him about the benefits of his criminal cases, His small dollar fundraising was surging. He was crushing Republicans in the nomination fight, and his base was rallying to his defense. But Trump stopped the conversation to remind the group of a problem. He had been indicted 4 times and was going to spend the next year in court. It's almost like you can't believe it, the person close to Trump said. There is a sense when you talk to him, can you believe this? They indicted me. Now captive to the courthouse for much of the day, Trump tries to exert influence over what he can, often serving as his own spokesman between sessions. On the first Thursday of the trial, the former president appeared brandishing a thick stack of news clippings, claiming that every article vindicated him. But his loss of power is evident. At one point, when he stood up, the judge immediately told him to sit down, and he did. When he has mumbled in court, the judge has reprimanded him. Privately, he has complained at times to his lawyers, giving suggestions for what arguments they should make, and sometimes second-guessing their arguments in the courtroom. But he is generally pleased with this set of attorneys, people close to him said. On Friday, he opened his morning media remarks by wishing his wife, Melania Trump, a happy birthday. It would be nice to be with her, but I'm in a courthouse for a rigged trial, Trump said. He rails against the lack of mass demonstrations outside, falsely claiming that police are keeping hordes of supporters away. On Monday, he declared on social media that the area outside the court was completely closed down, though some protesters had been chanting and walking on the sidewalk. By Tuesday, he was saying that thousands of people were turned away from the courthouse in Lower Manhattan by steel stanchions and police. There have been some minor demonstrations with appearances from far-right activist Laura Loomer and conservative commentator Andrew Giuliani. But on Thursday afternoon, 68-year-old Gary Faneuf was the only Trump supporter visibly protesting in the park outside the courthouse. Fight for Trump, the Staten Island resident shouted as other New Yorkers in the park went about their day. Faneuf, who was arrested for a curfew violation in Washington after the January 6, 2021 storming of the U.S. Capitol, said he was disappointed in the turnout for the trial. He speculated that Trump supporters got discouraged from mass mobilization after January 6th. We got nothing here right now, let's be real, Faneuf lamented. You don't see any prominent Republicans here today, do you? Trump has been mostly impassive when court is in session, sandwiched between lawyers at the defense table as reporters scrutinize his every move. Some days, his most notable reaction is a yawn. He frowned when David Pecker, the former National Enquirer publisher, discussed a Trump Tower doorman who had claimed falsely, Pecker said, that Trump had fathered a child outside his marriage. He briefly folded his arms in front of his chest when Pecker turned the topic of Karen McDougal, the Playboy model who alleged an affair with Trump. His tone during his brief appearances outside the trial room, meanwhile, has at times veered into outright mewling. I'm sitting here for days now. From morning till night in that freezing room, he moaned at one. Freezing. Everybody was freezing in there, and all for this. He has griped about the court-imposed gag order, complaining that he has been unfairly muzzled, and he says he should be out campaigning. I should be right now in Pennsylvania and Florida and many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning, Trump said last week. Some of Trump's grousing has provided an opening for the Biden campaign, which has gleefully seized on his daily remarks to portray him as feeble and infirm. Trump says he has difficulty sitting for long periods of time and staying awake, the Biden campaign wrote on X. At the end of the day, Trump returns to Trump Tower, his famous property in Manhattan. People close to Trump said he appears happiest in his gilded triplex there, which remains furnished from his time in New York. During evening dinners, the conversation often veers back to the case. Late Thursday afternoon, a small crowd began to gather outside the tower at the intersection of Fifth Avenue and East 56th Street. By just after 5 p.m., about 100 people were waiting to catch a glimpse of Trump, even though police insisted they would not be able to see anything besides the black vehicles. Some people waiting were the diehard fans whom Trump aides had made sure to highlight in their videos from New York. I love him, declared Lucy Cooper, 16, who said she was visiting from Boston. Others who wandered by were hostile. One man stopped to take a selfie under the chunky gold Trump Tower letters with his hand in the shape of an L for loser. John Hart Battles, a 17-year-old high school junior in Oklahoma, joined Planet Fitness last June to keep in shape as a member of his school's color guard team. As a young gay man, he liked Planet Fitness's focus on inclusivity, an approach that turned it into one of the leading fitness brands in the United States. He started going twice a week. But for the past few weeks, he, like many LGBTQ+ Planet Fitness patrons and staffers, has stayed away, as at least 54 bomb threats have been made to Planet Fitness locations across the country, many of which led to evacuations. "It's one of my worst fears, to be hate-crimed, specifically in a locker room," said Hart Battles, who called the attacks on Planet Fitness very unsettling. Local police and the FBI say that they have yet to determine who is behind the threats, which in some instances have forced the evacuation, police say, not just of Planet Fitness locations, but of businesses nearby. But the pattern is familiar to LGBTQ+ activists who link the wave of threats to far-right influencer Chaya Raichik, who runs the social media account at Libsoft TikTok. She has made Planet Fitness the object of critical posts since early March, when Planet Fitness revoked the membership of a woman in Alaska who complained about a man shaving in a woman's bathroom and posted a photo of the person online. Though the threats and evacuations have directly affected only a relative few of the chain's 2,600 locations in the United States, the attacks have caused fear and anxiety among LGBTQ+ people across the country, some of whom said they are now too anxious to use their local Planet Fitness or set foot in the locker room. Our gender identity non-discrimination policy states that members and guests may use the gym facilities that best align with their sincere self-reported gender identity, a Planet Fitness spokesperson said in a statement following the Alaska incident. The member who posted on social media violated our mobile device policy that prohibits taking photos of individuals in the locker room, which resulted in their membership being terminated. Raichik, who operates the Libs of TikTok account on X and Instagram, declined to comment for the story. She previously has denied responsibility for threats leveled at businesses, schools, and hospitals. She has criticized for LGBTQ+ inclusive policies. After the Alaska incident, Raichik criticized Planet Fitness's trans-inclusive policies and encouraged her more than 3 million followers to boycott the chain. She has posted dozens of times since, encouraging followers to protest the gym in an effort to take back our country, and documenting updates in a thread that she titled Planet Fitness Bloodbath Mega Thread. In late March, she posted a video interview with Planet Fitness co-founder and former CEO Michael Grondahl, who left the company in 2013. "I'd want to go in there and freaking take the guy by the neck and throw him out in the parking lot," Grondahl said in the interview. "That's the way things would have been done a while back." Violent threats have followed Raichik's tweets before, including dozens of bomb threats against LGBTQ+ pride events, children's hospitals that provide gender-affirming care, drag queen story hours, and at least 24 public schools and libraries. Schools in California, Colorado, and Oklahoma have canceled classes and evacuated students following libs of TikTok posts about them. Raichik recently compared her Planet Fitness post with last year's controversy after Anheuser-Busch paid a trans influencer to tout a beer brand in an Instagram post. "This might be the most successful boycott since Bud Light," she said. Planet Fitness's stock price is down more than 7.5% since the incident in Alaska, but it's unclear how much, if any, of that is due to Raichik's call for a boycott. Its value has dipped over 20% over the past year, a turbulent period that saw top-level turnover and scandal before this controversy. Planet Fitness declined to provide a count of how many locations have been threatened. The nonprofit media watchdog Media Matters has cataloged the attacks in its ongoing efforts to document anti-LGBTQ+ hate online, and that tabulation has been confirmed by police departments and local news accounts. "We have been working closely with local and federal authorities to investigate these threats and will continue to take action to ensure the safety of our members and employees," a Planet Fitness spokesperson told the Washington Post. The 54 incidents are national in nature. 7 Planet Fitness's locations in Virginia have been targeted, and at least 2 in Maryland, according to the tabulation. In Fargo, North Dakota, 2 locations were evacuated, and a franchise manager explained to police that this has been happening across the country at their other locations since the incident in Alaska, a police report shows. On Friday, a bomb threat to a Planet Fitness location in Charlottesville caused a nearby street to be closed to traffic during rush hour, police said. It was at least the 2nd threat to the same location. The Planet Fitness employee who answered the phones at that location shortly after the incident said they are not allowed to say anything. It's just not disrupting Planet Fitness businesses. A lot of these locations are in plazas with multiple businesses, said Lieutenant Nicholas Rankin of the Northridge Police Department in Connecticut. We didn't just evacuate Planet Fitness, we were forced to evacuate a Big Lots department store and a healthcare facility. One transgender Planet Fitness staffer who spoke on the condition of anonymity for their safety told the Post that they initially heard about the campaign when a member called the club screaming and ranting heinously transphobic nonsense. They were screaming about pedophiles, calling me a pedophile, I was misgendered over the phone. They jumped right into talking about men and women's locker rooms, everything you've been saying in comments online, but directed at me personally, the staffer said. I don't feel comfortable going into the bathroom now at my own job. Grondahl said he and Raychick deserve no blame for the rash of threats. Number one, nothing's happened. Grondahl said, it's bomb threats. I mean, it's crazies doing what crazies do. I haven't seen any violence towards anybody. In Grondahl, the Planet Fitness founder who built the brand on inclusivity, Raychick has found an unlikely ally. Grondahl and his brother Mark brought their first gym in the early 1990s and parlayed it into the fitness empire, branded as a judgment-free zone, because it welcomed everybody except for the bodybuilders to whom the industry had previously catered. The Grondahl brothers cut membership fees to the bone, created a lunk alarm, a siren that would go off if weightlifters grunted too loudly, and hosted a monthly pizza night. They were all measures to make the gym feel like, as the company's stock filing stated, a place where anyone, and we mean anyone, can feel they belong. The pitch worked, with the chain signing up millions of members. The company's market capitalization is now more than $5 billion. Grondahl said his downfall at the company began with the rise of an executive with a controversial criminal past. Richard Moore started as Planet Fitness's chief administrative officer and general counsel in 2012, according to his LinkedIn profile. 12 years earlier, Moore, at the time a North Carolina assemblyman, was indicted on charges of crimes of nature for allegedly engaging in oral sex with three former students at the high school where he taught, court records show. The youngest of the former students was 16, North Carolina's age of consent. Moore pleaded guilty to a felony count of crimes against nature and two misdemeanor counts of attempted crimes against nature. That statute has been challenged for potentially criminalizing same-gender sex. In a later letter to the Massachusetts Bar, which allowed Moore to be licensed as an attorney, Moore acknowledged that the relationships were inappropriate. Moore said in a statement to the Post, "In retrospect, I regret the choices I made in my early 20s. However, there were no underage individuals involved and all contact was consensual." Richard Moore has not worked at Planet Fitness in nearly 7 years and no involvement with the company, a spokesperson said when asked about the former general counsel. In Grondahl's telling, a clash with Moore was central to his exit from the company. He stepped down as CEO in late 2012 and left the company's board the following year, he said, and he was paid roughly $140 million for his shares. In his interview with Raychick, Grondahl said he was shown the door when he tried to raise the alarm about Moore's past. By Grondahl's own account, drug abuse played a role. He told the Post that as CEO, he was in a daily stupor from Ambien, other prescription drugs, and booze, and that he believes the signature on his separation agreement was forged while he was impaired. Planet Fitness disputes that claim. Since his departure, the former CEO has had no involvement with the company or insight into Planet Fitness's operations, strategy, performance, or culture, a company spokesman said. A reporter from the Post visited Grondahl last year at his mansion in Jupiter, Florida. Grondahl was in full war room mode, having put a team of lawyers and investigators on retainer to prove his allegations. Grondahl recently told the Post that he spent roughly $100,000 a month over the past year, plus attempting to build a case, but his planned lawsuit has not been filed. Then came the bathroom incident at the Planet Fitness in Alaska. Grondahl's team reached out to conservative news outlets, though there are indications that they were wary of airing Grondahl's claims. Grondahl said that Fox News arranged for Jesse Waters to interview him, but then canceled. And a Newsmax interview aired, but was edited, according to Grondahl, to remove inflammatory comments concerning Moore. A Fox News spokesperson declined to comment. Newsmax did not respond to a request for comment. But Raychick aired a mostly unedited interview with Grondahl. Flanked by his attorney, Grondahl alleged that the company harbored sexual abusers and that it was devastating to see the welcoming philosophy, Ecoy Now, being made to include trans people. fast forward to what's happening today, and judgment free zone means that if you're a man, you can use the woman's locker room, Grondahl said. Just insane. Meanwhile, Raychick has continued to post. Last week, she lambasted the company's new CEO, Colleen Keating, for signing on to the CEO Action for Diversity and Inclusion Pledge, which supports inclusive workplaces, claiming that the company was standing by its woke policies. Haley Zappel, an LGBTQ+ Planet Fitness member in Atlanta, said that she hopes the company can remain publicly supportive of the trans community and not cave to online pressure. If they're prioritizing safety, Zappel said, I think they should keep in mind who is doing the aggression, and it doesn't seem like it's the trans people. As CEO, Elon Musk stakes the future of Tesla on autonomous driving. Lawyers from California to Florida are picking apart the company's most common driver assistance technology in painstaking detail, arguing that autopilot is not safe for widespread use by the public. At least 8 lawsuits headed to trial in the coming year, including 2 that haven't been previously reported, involve fatal or otherwise serious crashes that occurred while the driver was allegedly relying on autopilot. The complaints argue that Tesla exaggerated the capabilities of the feature, which controls steering, speed, and other actions typically left to the driver. As a result, the lawsuits claim the company created a false sense of complacency that led the drivers to tragedy. Evidence emerging in the cases, including dashcam video obtained by the Washington Post, offers sometimes shocking details. In Phoenix, a woman allegedly relying on autopilot plows into a disabled car and is then struck and killed by another vehicle after exiting her Tesla. In Tennessee, an intoxicated man allegedly using autopilot drives down the wrong side of the road for several minutes before barreling into an oncoming car, killing the 20-year-old inside. Tesla maintains that it is not liable for the crashes because the driver is ultimately in control of the vehicle, but that contention is coming under increasing pressure, including from several regulators. Late Thursday, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration launched a new review of autopilot, signaling concern that a December recall failed to significantly improve misuse of the technology, and that drivers are misled into thinking the automation has greater capabilities than it does. Meanwhile, in a twist, Tesla this month settled a high-profile case in Northern California that claimed autopilot played a role in the fatal crash of an Apple engineer, Walter Wong. The company's decision to settle with Wong's family, along with a ruling from a Florida judge concluding that Tesla had knowledge that its technology was flawed under certain conditions, is giving fresh momentum to cases once seen as long shots, legal experts said. A reckoning is coming as more and more of these cases are going to see the light of a jury trial, said Brett Schreiber, a lawyer with Singleton Schreiber, who is representing the family of Giovanni Maldonado, 15, who was killed in Northern California when a Tesla, an autopilot, rear-ended his family's pickup truck in 2019. Tesla did not respond to multiple requests for comment on the lawsuits. The outcomes of the cases could be critical for the company. Tesla's stock has lost more than a third of its value since the beginning of the year. Last week, the company reported a steeper-than-expected 55% plunge in first-quarter profit as it struggles with falling sales of electric vehicles and stiff competition from China. To allay investors' concerns, Musk has made lofty promises about launching a fully autonomous robo-taxi in August. Soon, he said during Tuesday's earnings call, driving a car will be like riding an elevator. You get on and get out at your destination. We should be thought of as an AI robotics company, Musk told investors. If somebody doesn't believe Tesla is going to solve autonomy, I think they should not be an investor in the company, but we will. Meanwhile, the company has defended itself in court documents by arguing that its user manuals and on-screen warnings make extremely clear that drivers must be fully in control while using autopilot. Many of the upcoming court cases involve driver distraction or impairment. Autopilot is not a self-driving technology and does not replace the driver, Tesla said in response to a 2020 case filed in Florida. The driver can and must still brake, accelerate, and steer just as if the system is not engaged. But the Wong case also potentially involved a distracted driver. Wong was allegedly playing a video game when his Tesla plowed into a highway barrier in 2018. Tesla has not said why it decided to settle the lawsuit, and details of the settlement have not yet been disclosed in court documents. Meanwhile, federal regulators appear increasingly sympathetic to claims that Tesla oversells its technology and misleads drivers. Even the decision to call the software Autopilot elicits the idea of drivers not being in control and invites drivers to overly trust the automation. NHTSA said Thursday, revealing that a two-year investigation into Autopilot had identified 467 crashes linked to the technology, 13 of them fatal. NHTSA did not offer specific information about those crashes. But two fatal crashes from 2022 are detailed in lawsuits that have not been previously reported. In Phoenix, Awanda Mitchell, 49, was driving a Tesla in May 2022 when she struck a Toyota Camry that had stalled on the highway, according to court documents and dash cam footage obtained by the Post. According to the Mitchell family's lawyer, Jonathan Michaels, with MLG Attorneys at Law, Autopilot and the car's other features, including forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking, failed to result in Mitchell's Tesla taking evasive action and prevent the vehicle from barreling into the stalled sedan. Mitchell was then struck and killed by an oncoming vehicle when she got out of her car. Tesla did not respond to a request for comment regarding the case. In response to the complaint in January 2024, Tesla said it denies the allegation and has not yet had an opportunity to inspect Mitchell's vehicle. About a month later, in Sumner County, Tennessee, Jose Roman Jaramillo Cortez drank two beers and three tequila shots after his shift at a local restaurant and then hopped into his Tesla Model 3, court documents say. He plugged his address into the Tesla's GPS and flicked on autopilot, it said. According to the lawsuit filed in June 2023 and dash cam footage obtained by the Post, the car then pulled onto the wrong side of the road. After driving south in a northbound lane for several minutes, the Tesla rammed into a car driven by Christian Malone, 20, who died from the impact. In its response to the complaint, Tesla said the crash was caused by the negligence and/or recklessness of the driver. Trial dates for both cases will be set later next year, Michael said. In another case set for trial in November in Key Largo, Florida, a Tesla in autopilot allegedly failed to detect an approaching T intersection while its driver searched for a dropped phone. The Tesla barreled through flashing lights and a physical barricade before crashing into a vehicle parked on the side of the road, killing a woman and seriously injuring a man. In court documents, Tesla has argued that the driver was ultimately responsible for the trajectory of the car. Tesla also states in user manuals that autopilot may not operate as intended when unable to accurately determine lane markings or when bright light is interfering with the camera's view. When these cases head to trial, juries may be asked to consider whether Tesla's many driver warnings are sufficient to spare the company from liability. Ross Gerber, CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management, said the last thing the company needs is a highly publicized courtroom battle that focuses attention on such questions. At a trial, the defense would dig into the weeds, and it would become very clear that the perception of the autopilot software was very different from the reality, Gerber said. Every day would be a headline, and it would be embarrassing. So far, Tesla has faced a jury only once over the role autopilot may have played in a fatal crash. In Riverside, California last year, a jury heard the case of Michael Lee, 37, who was allegedly using autopilot when his Tesla Model 3 suddenly veered off the highway at 65 miles per hour, crashed into a palm tree, and burst into flames. Lee died of his injuries while his fiancée and her son were severely injured. Because of the extensive damage to the car, Tesla said it cannot be proved that autopilot was engaged at the time of the crash. During the trial, Michael Carey, the attorney for Tesla, argued the technology was not at fault and that the crash is classic human error. According to a toxicology report taken after the crash, Lee had alcohol in his system, but it was within the legal limit in California. This case is not about autopilot. Autopilot didn't cause the crash, Carey said during opening statements. This is a bad crash with bad injuries and may have resulted from bad mistakes, but you can't blame the car company when that happens. This is a good car with a good design. Ultimately, Tesla's arguments prevailed and a jury found the company not liable. But the company appears to face headwinds in some other cases. Last year, Florida Circuit Judge Reed Scott upheld a plaintiff's request to seek punitive damages in a case concerning a fatal crash in Delray Beach, Florida. In 2019, when Jeremy Banner and his Tesla in autopilot failed to register a semi-truck crossing its path, the car plowed under the truck at full speed, killing Banner on impact. In the ruling, Scott said the family's lawyer sufficiently presented evidence to reasonably seek punitive damages at trial, which could run millions of dollars. The plaintiff's evidence included that Tesla knew the vehicle at issue had a defective autopilot system, according to the order. Citing other fatal crashes involving autopilot, Scott wrote that there is a genuine dispute over whether Tesla created a foreseeable zone of risk that posed a general threat of harm to others. Tesla's appeal of the ruling is pending. As the spate of lawsuits turns forward, Tesla has shown a fresh willingness to settle such cases, despite Musk's vow on Twitter in 2022 to never settle an unjust case against us, even if we will probably lose. In addition to settling the Wong case, Tesla indicated that it was open to discussing a potential settlement in the Riverside case, as it was being presented to a jury last fall, said Michaels, the MLG lawyer who represented Lee's family. The month-long trial featured testimony from an accident reconstructionist, a top engineer at Tesla, and a paramedic who responded to the crash and said it was among the most horrific accidents he had ever seen. Michael said he declined to engage in settlement talks because he wanted to continue to make this a really public issue. He said he also did not have confidence in our ability to come to an agreeable amount. Tesla and its lawyer in the case, Carrie, did not respond to a request for comment. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury decided the case in Tesla's favor. Though he lost, Michael said the trial attracted media attention and gave other lawyers with cases against Tesla insight into the company's defense strategy. Plus, he said his law firm's phone has since been blowing up with potential clients. "We walked away from guaranteed money," Michael said, "but that wasn't what it was about." Abdullah Hamid had been outspoken about Israel's assault in Gaza and President Biden's unconditional support of Israel for nearly 4 months, but he had not attracted much attention outside his native Dearborn, Michigan. That all changed in late January when he made a decision that would catapult him from little-known mayor to national figure. Biden's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, was coming to town, a fellow Arab-American official told Hamid. How would the Dearborn mayor feel about meeting with her? Something didn't sit right with Hamid. Israel's military campaign in Gaza had killed more than 25,000 Palestinians. Hamid had heard from residents of this majority Arab-American city who had lost 20, 40, even 80 relatives. The war was spreading to southern Lebanon and Yemen, where many of Dearborn's residents had ancestral roots. This was the first outreach he had received from anyone in the Biden camp, and it was not a White House official with the ability to influence policy, but someone whose sole job was getting the president reelected. Hamid, a Democratic mayor of a city of just over 100,000 residents, made a decision that sent an unmistakable message. He turned down the meeting. That was a concept people couldn't understand. Why would you do that? Hamid said in a recent interview while driving around Dearborn, "Immediately when I got the invitation, I felt like it was a disingenuous engagement. It was an engagement only for the worry of what's going to happen in the upcoming election, and not for the worry of what's actually happening to the people on the ground and to their friends and family and my residents." Since then, Hamid, the first Arab-American and Muslim mayor of Dearborn, has had to navigate myriad cross-currents. He has spoken with White House officials, though not campaign operatives, who have looked to him to try to understand his constituents' anger at the president and what it might take to win them back. He has become a prominent voice for Arab-American and Muslim voters, not just in Dearborn, but across the country, who say that Biden has betrayed and dehumanized them. And still, the 34-year-old Hamid has to keep his attention on the job he was elected to do, overseeing the city of Dearborn. He now spends hours discussing foreign policy and the political fallout of Biden's support of Israel. But his days are filled with meetings about budgets, flooding, community parks, and city events. "I ran for office on the idea that I'd ensure your garbage was picked up on time," Hamid said. He has received numerous invitations for dinners and speaking engagements related to the war, but he has turned most of them down. "It's humbling," he said, "but I try to tell folks I'm still the mayor of Dearborn, and this is my primary focus." After rejecting the meeting with Chavez Rodriguez, Hamid made clear that he would only meet with policymakers, not campaign operatives. 2 weeks later, the White House sent a high-level delegation to Dearborn that included John Finer, Biden's deputy national security advisor, and Samantha Power, the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development. The Israel-Gaza war is, on its face, a foreign policy issue thousands of miles away from a mid-sized city in Michigan. But it occupies a unique space in Dearborn, where it has in essence become a local issue, now consuming the community for more than 6 months. The city is a little more than 50% Arab-American and sits in a swing state that is crucial to Biden's path to a second term. Residents have organized dozens of protests and fundraisers since October 7th, when Hamas militants rampaged through the Israel-Gaza border fence and killed 1,200 people, many of them civilians, and took 253 other hostages into Gaza, according to Israeli authorities. In response, Israel launched a punishing military assault that has killed more than 33,000 Palestinians, the majority of whom are women and children, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Israel's siege of the enclave has also created a humanitarian catastrophe, as Gaza's health system has collapsed and its residents face famine. Michigan is home to the nation's largest Arab American and Muslim population, with about 300,000 people who claim ancestry from the Middle East or North Africa, and that community overwhelmingly supported Biden in 2020. Biden won Michigan by 154,000 votes in 2020 and is expected to face another tight contest this year against former President Donald Trump. That is about all the time we have for this Monday. This is Claire Field signing off from the Washington Post.